This episode of The Line is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek.fm at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. And if you want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode, join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
You're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to a brand new show on Trek.fm, Tracks on the Line, where we're going to be eventually taking a look at every single episode of Star Trek Picard and providing audio commentary for those episodes.
Yeah.
But we've got some time before that show starts off, so in the meantime, what we're going to be doing is taking a look at some classic Picard episodes, or episodes which may in some way or another tie into what they're going to be doing on Star Trek Picard, and providing audio commentary for those.
Yep.
I'm Mike.
And I'm Max.
And you may know us from Tracks from the Edge, which is not at all like Tracks on the Line, two completely different things. We're not following the same exact format or anything like that. It's going to be completely different. You have no idea what we might be doing on this show. You have no idea.
You talking to me? Because that's true. I have no idea.
Okay, yeah. But yeah, we also did the good old commentary, Trek Stars, and some other things here and there. But now we're going to be just talking about some Picard. So why would we want to do this?
Well, I think mainly because we're obsessed with Picard.
Well, that could be. That could be.
That's the main thing.
Yeah, we are obsessed with Picard. I mean, I'm not going to say that I'm obsessed with Picard. Maybe are you obsessed with Picard? I would say that I have a fondness for Picard. But where does he rank in your captains, in your Star Trek captains ranking?
That's not a thing for me. Okay. I don't care about the rankings of Star Trek leaders or any of that. To me, he stands out as a role model. Like, to me, he was an adult male that I was like, okay, yeah, he's legitimately awesome and undeniably cool and, like, really a great person, like a genuinely good person. And there's a lot going on there, but that's the main thing that I think hooked me into the character.
Yeah, I mean, for me, like, I came into it with the came into Star Trek with the Star Trek movies, the original series movies, and then I just branched out into Next Generation naturally because that was the one that was on every day, Monday through Saturday at 6 p.m. on WPWR Power 50 here in Chicago. So it sort of became like my default Trek, but I quickly saw a difference between Kirk and Picard and like the way that I was sort of like responding to the shows because of that. Like, Kirk is fun. And I'm going to say that, yeah, Kirk is my favorite captain because William Shatner is a total goofball. And I think that his performance as Kirk and pretty much every other character he's ever played is hilarious. So I enjoy watching Kirk on screen, but Picard is, I think, a much better written character in a lot of ways. And like you're saying, he is a role model. Like, he is someone who solves problems with his mind, you know, kind of like Professor X.
Yeah, that's the only thing they really have in common.
Yeah, yeah.
And the baldness. But, I mean, like, yeah, for me, it was definitely who he was, like, as a person more than anything else. And, you know, I mean, as, you know, growing up, it's important to have a role model. And for me, it was a big deal that he was, like, he was a guy. And, like, I could say, I think Picard is cool. And people were like, yeah, I agree, Picard is cool. And I was like, okay, then it's okay for me to really want to be him. Like, there's a lot going on there, you know? I mean, but I think, certainly for me, who, you know, like people like me who didn't have like an active father in their lives, like having a guy like Jean-Luc Picard on TV was a big deal.
Yeah. And we'll get into like where we were like age wise in a minute. But before we do, well, we could do that right now. Yeah. And then we'll segue into that other thing. So how old were you when this show started? And here's a unique thing, something which I've always found fascinating, especially since we were living in the days of syndicated television. You saw every single episode of Next Generation as it aired.
Yeah.
You didn't, like, miss a single one.
It's possible that I didn't see every single one of them that at the moment it aired, but I saw every single one of them in order. Because I possibly taped one and then watched it later in the week. But yeah, I never missed one.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive. And I have to say that's the only reason why I let you go to the trade screening of Star Trek Nemesis and worked your shift for you instead of going myself. Because I was like, you earned it. You get to see Nemesis first. Yeah. You
and
earned
in retrospect... In retrospect, it seems almost like you got a warning from the future.
I'm just saying, you know?
Yeah.
So, when it was announced that this thing might be a thing that was happening, I think we were both pretty excited. And then when Patrick Stewart came out on stage at Vegas and everything like that, That was obviously a big deal. When it became official, when that thing happened, what was your reaction?
My real reaction was entirely private, and I didn't really share it with anyone. But it was pretty serious. It was I had a real emotional, powerful reaction to it. It was like I knew it was coming. I knew that this was coming. We'd heard the rumors.
We said that it was going to happen on the podcast that we recorded a week before it happened. Like literally the way it happened.
I agree. And the thing is, like, we knew it would happen. That was a given. I was not surprised to see a clip of Patrick Stewart at the convention announcing something. And when I watched it, I was like, I know what this is. And then when he said it, I was like, okay, that's something. All right. I'm glad nobody's around here. Cause you know, the image that people have of me as the tough as nails, you know,
yeah,
like the guy Clint Eastwood type, you know,
yeah, you don't like anything. You have no emotions. Yeah.
But like I was pretty moved, and it was surprising because I knew it was coming. And then when I heard him say it, I was like, "Oh, I need this."
Yeah,
that was a big deal.
Yeah. So we're excited about this, and we have a deep love for Patrick Stewart and his, I'm assuming, I don't know, and his work as Captain Picard, and also Star Trek The Next Generation. And I say all this because the episode that we're going to kick this off with,
oh yeah,
it just makes sense. I mean, you have to watch this one first. It's the first appearance of Captain Picard, Encounter at Farpoint, right? And the reason why I bring this up is because one reputation that you in particular have, Max, and I'd say our show in particular has, is, you know, I don't know, maybe overly critical of some elements of Star Trek, okay? And I just want everyone to know that it's going to get better, right? Okay, we all know this. We've all seen Encounter at Farpoint. We all know that it's not good. So next time, we're going to take a look at All Good Things, and I can assure you that we will have nothing but praise for that one. Well, maybe not nothing but praise, but like 95% praise for that one, right?
Yeah, I would say that's right. It's got a couple problems, and I'm not even including the old age makeup.
Yeah. But for the most part, it's pretty solid.
It holds up. It's a great episode. I mean, it's a great movie. It should have been the movie, whatever.
Yeah. So let's take a look. Encounter at Farpoint, shall we?
Yeah, let's take a look at it.
For those people who may not be familiar with the format, we are going to start this up at zero on the counter on, well, whatever version of Encounter at Farpoint is complete. So like the full 90-minute thing, not the broken up into two parts like it is on CBS All Access. Don't watch that. Well, you can. I mean, you could just, it's going to be, there's stuff missing. No, don't do that.
Don't do that.
Find another format, whatever. Or just don't watch the episode. I mean, you've seen Encounter at Farpoint. You didn't watch that again. I watched it the other day, and I was like, why am I watching this? And now I'm going to watch it again.
Guys, we're doing this so you don't need to.
But
we're taking one for the team, and this one is 90 minutes long.
and we're going to be watching it and providing audio commentary with it. So if you want to watch the episode while we talk about it, go to zero on the counter now. If you don't, that's fine too. But we are going to be starting it up on the count of three. So if you're ready, Max.
Yeah.
3, 2, 1, start. Oh.
I see Earth.
Yeah, and so this is the, well, for one thing, it's the season one opening, right?
Mm-hmm.
They didn't do it in season two, right? This was just season one, right? Pretty sure.
They did change the credits. I thought it was season three.
I thought they did it in season two, but I could be wrong. Whatever, who cares?
It don't matter.
And it's
all that matters is that the planets are way too close together.
And it's happening without a teaser. That's kind of unique for Star Trek The Next Generation. It's only happened once, and this is it.
I mean, I think there's a good reason for it. I mean, like, it's been how long since Star Trek was on TV? It makes sense. Like right at the beginning, you gotta tell people we're in space.
Yeah. So yeah, looking at this cast, you know, there's Patrick Stewart and then LeVar Burton. Like when you were 9 years old, and someone, like let's say someone came up to you and said, "Oh, there's going to be another Star Trek series featuring Picard, and it's going to star Patrick Stewart, and Commander Riker is going to direct episodes 3 and 4 of this show, and it's going to air like 32 years from now." What would your reaction have been?
Hold on. Wait, what the heck is this question? Are you asking me if I had been a child watching this episode and somebody appears from the future and tells me that one day there will be a show called Picard starring Patrick Stewart, and the guy who plays Riker will be directing several episodes of that show, and that show will air on an app called CBS All Access.
Yeah, and it'll be shot in anamorphic widescreen.
I would burst into tears because I would have been a child being confronted with a barrage of really shocking revelations about the future.
Yeah, I could see that.
I probably wouldn't have taken it great.
All right. Well, okay, that's fair then. Oh, here he is. Here he is. Captain Picard.
Yeah.
Looking right into the camera. Oh, and look at this, a handheld shot. This is the first and last time there was a handheld shot on Star Trek The Next Generation. Fun fact.
It's wild.
You know, everyone makes fun of the scans, and, you know, rightfully so, they don't work. But I think we all forget to acknowledge how progressive that was for like 1987. They were just like, oh, you know, guys can wear skirts. What's the big deal, dude?
I think that the decision to have it in this show and to have it be like a unisex uniform, there's some positive like forward momentum there, but it's also, to me, it smacks of a desperation to justify the past, because they had this crazy thing in the original show, and this is supposed to not be a humongous length of time in the future from that, so we have to assume that whatever sort of like sexual politics progress we have must have been mostly in the past by that point. So the having the scant on male crew members was, hey guys, it wasn't that ridiculous that we had all the girls wearing this crazy short skirt thing, right? Can we all be cool about this now?
I guess that's one way to look at it. Yeah. Oh, and here we see Data for the first time. It is weird that he doesn't know what Snoop means. You know?
Yeah, I have a lot of, you know, like headcanon when I'm watching anything, and early episodes of Next Generation, I've got volumes of it for watching this.
Well, I mean, it is like, I mean, you can totally tell, and I mean, you could tell back that, like, you could, you know, 25 years ago, All Good Things aired, and of course, everybody went back and watched. I think actually on Channel 50, they showed Encounter at Farpoint like the day before or something like that, so that everyone would be ready. And you can totally see that thing that you see in pretty much every TV pilot, which is everything is kind of like amped up in a weird direction because no one is really comfortable with these characters who they would end up playing for, oh, you know, in some cases, like 32 years. And because of that, they're more than anything, like, shouty, you know? I mean, this one probably more than most because it's, like, sort of military and it's got that history from the original series and everything. But that seems to be a thing just in general with pilots, is the characters are much more shouty. I don't know why, but just is, you know?
Yeah, there's a lot of weird stuff going on. I mean, there's a point in this episode where one of the crew members says, like, we have a reading on the sensors, this sensor circuit. He says, this sensor circuit. And that's a bananas line. Like, there's a lot of stuff that's going on here, and like, Data's smiling periodically, like, just like Spock. They did the same thing again. They made the same mistake. He's logical. He doesn't have emotions, but he smiles occasionally for no reason.
But Data's smiles are, like, classic. You know what I mean? Like, marvelous. You know what I mean? Not like, that's funny, but like, wow. You know what I mean?
Bro, no.
Okay, it's okay. Don't worry about it.
Oh, God, I hate this. He's frozen. Oh, God.
Well, I mean, one of the things which I find to be super duper fascinating about this episode is that, of course, as everyone knows, there was a big fight behind the scenes as to whether or not it should be 2 hours or 90 minutes. Yes. And it ended up being 2 hours, which, you know, if it were only 90 minutes, I think my 13-year-old brain would have just snapped because I wouldn't have known how to classify this. You know, is it one episode? Is it two episodes? Is it one and a half episodes? How does that work? I don't know what I you know, it would have been
oh
like,
oh my God, the Schindler brain, you know? Like, you need to have everything in categories and neat little boxes and like all it's oh my God.
Yeah. I mean, when you look at season two and it's like only 24 episodes or whatever it is, and I'm just like, it messes up everything. Anyway, so they made it 2 hours, even though it was originally designed as only an hour and a half. And if memory serves, the stuff that they added was all of the Q stuff. Like, this episode originally just didn't have Q in it.
Yeah.
And that's insane.
Well, because, I mean, like, there's a lot of crazy stuff that led up to this point in this thing that we call Star Trek, because like a lot of this was phase two material. And a lot
some
of it
was, yeah.
And some of the phase two material got metamorphosed into a different form because of the motion picture. And then like a lot of those pieces got like taken apart and put back together and reassembled into this. And like you can see the through line that connects them all. And then when we got here, like it's, for the most part, it's like an adaptation, and like they've sort of slapped a few things into place, and you can see the original series pieces, you can see the phase two pieces, you can see the motion picture elements, and there's a lot going on that led to this, and that's why it does feel very disjointed. Like there are two different stories here, yeah, and they don't really fit together. Like Q makes this big deal about how they're going to be tested, and then they like deal with this weird, you know, alien jellyfish, and they're like, "Oh, let's not kill the alien jellyfish." And Q's like, "Well, you passed the test, I guess. You didn't kill the alien jellyfish. That's a good, I mean, there are harder things that they deal with. Like in 2 or 3 weeks, they deal with some hard stuff."
Yeah. Yeah. But you know,
and I mean, two, there's one that's not great.
Q was playing the long game, and you know, that all came back into play 7 years later with All Good Things. Right.
Yeah. I mean, like just like the Scant, they retroactively justified it. Kinda.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But, yeah, you know, it's weird because, like this, like all of this stuff at the beginning, take like before they even like go down to the planet, it's like 25 minutes or something like that. So clearly, I mean, obviously there were a billion revisions which were made to the script in order to get it into what it is today. But like there's more Q stuff than just that extra half hour. And yet still it's short. You can tell that it ran short because you can tell there are a number of scenes which just go on for too long because they're trying to stretch out the time in order to make it fit the slot, you know?
Yes, and still, and a lot of things in Star Trek history have this sort of like, how long are we playing this for? This episode really does feel draggy. There are points where you're like, "Ooh, this is kind of a long scene," but there's only like 2 or 3 times where I get frustrated, and strangely, as I've grown up, the point that blew my mind as a child now infuriates me when they're separating the saucer.
Uh-huh.
That takes so long, and it is not fun to watch. But as a kid, I was like, "What? This is amazing. Can you believe what they're doing? Shut up. I'm watching this." That's because
you were a 9-year-old kid who grew up on the original series and was a huge Star Trek fan going into this, and when that happened, it blew your mind.
Like, yeah, I know what was going on. It was just so cool to see that.
Yeah, for me, it was a completely different experience because I did not grow up with Star Trek. I saw the movies, the original movies, like 1 through 5, and then I immediately jumped into Next Gen, and I just jumped in where they were at. I mean, season 3, you know, that was like The Hunted was the first episode that I saw, and I was just catching them as I could, and I had Mr. Larry Nemechek's Star Trek The Next Generation companion, which was basically my Bible in junior high, and I read his synopses. I saw Star Trek The Next Generation through the eyes of Larry Nemechek before I actually saw it through my own eyes, you know? So I knew everything that was going to happen or everything that did happen, and then I knew everything that went into it behind the scenes before I even watched it. So I never like even had a chance to emotionally connect to it or anything like that because I had seen all of this stuff in my mind already, you know?
Yeah, that's really weird.
That's the like, way it works.
Not only was I watching it as it aired, I actually was eagerly anticipating it. Like I was also like I wasn't completely blown away by the saucer separation. I was blown away by seeing it, but I actually knew it was going to happen because I had read articles about this upcoming Star Trek show.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was another thing. I mean, like, I can't relate to that with this, but I can relate to it with Generations, and I can tell you that I knew basically every beat in that movie before walking into the theater. It was people, I think, have trouble remembering or knowing, if they weren't, you know, around back then, like, what it was like. But, like, I came across an article, a set visit for Batman Forever, which was published a year before the movie came out. And in that article, Joel Schumacher reveals the entire plot of the movie. I'm not talking about just, like, teases things or whatever. Like, he literally says what the climax of the movie is, you know? And no one cared. That was just part of the marketing a year before the movie came out. Now, I mean, geez, you know, Thanos requests your silence, right? I mean, anyway.
And honestly, why would you listen to him? He's a psycho. Like, if Thanos requests my silence, I'm going to blab.
All right.
It's an act of civil disobedience. Okay. But like, as a grade schooler, like, I had a few friends who were all Star Trek fans, and like, I was, you know, like, I had like newspaper clippings and magazine articles about this show that was coming. And I was like reading them, and like, I made friends with a couple kids who were also Star Trek obsessed people, and like, it was weird, like, because like, between like the three of us, we were like a little tiny like Star Trek fan club in the cafeteria of my grade school, and we were very well informed, like, we knew like ratings once the show started airing.
Okay.
That's like, when they got so renewed for season two, we were like, can you believe it? There's going to be more. That's incredible. Like, this is so great. I mean, wow. It's wild. In retrospect, like, I learned basically how TV works because of this show, unlike a lot of different ways.
No, the same thing is true for me. Absolutely. Yeah. 100%. But yeah, so, I mean, I guess, there was a question which I didn't ask you, but like, when you saw this back in 1987 as a 9-year old, what was your reaction to it?
I don't know what my moment to moment reaction was. I don't remember exactly how I felt at the end of the episode, but like, the primary reaction was Star Trek is back. Mm-hmm. And nothing else mattered. Like, if like, my uncle came in and was like, this is not good, I'd be like, shut up. It's Star Trek. Like, it's back. It doesn't matter if an episode is bad here or there. You've watched the original series. You know that's not how it works. Like, there are a lot of bad episodes. You got to make your peace with that. This is Star Trek, and they're doing what they do. They're going to miss a lot, and that's all. That's fine.
Yeah.
And I was really ready for it. I was prepared. I was on board.
I can't say that this, you know, I mean, this was obviously, as I was going through my first time watch of Next Generation and starting with season three, because that's just where they were in the cycle of daily reruns, and then eventually ending up with this.
Real lucky, bro.
I mean, well, you figure it took them like 5 weeks to get through a season, so it was probably like 4 months before I got to this, something like that. Well, no, because they were only probably like 2 or 3 months, but it felt like forever. This was obviously one where I was like, I cannot wait, you know, because it's the first, right? It's where it all began. And, you know, you wanted to see that, and I saw it, and I was like, oh, that's not good. You know?
No.
Okay.
It's not good.
No. Yeah, it's not good. But hey, it is what it is. So they just introduced Chief O'Brien here, setting up Deep Space Nine. So that's cool.
Yeah, early setup for Deep Space Nine. They had the long game in mind. They were ready. They were like, Q's coming back in 6 years and 25 episodes. It's going to be pretty great. There's a lot going on. Another crazy thing is that I knew everyone's name before the show aired.
Oh, that's how it was for me with Voyager, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think I knew everyone's name on Voyager before it aired, but like I was, you know, single digits, and like that was the first time that I knew a lot about anything before it dropped. And it was only because I was a humongous fan of the original series and the movies.
Yeah. I just noticed that in the subtitles, they actually do refer to him as O'Brien. That's pretty great. Because obviously he was just random con officer, you know, here. Mm-hmm. So, okay, Q. Obviously, super duper important to Next Generation in particular, maybe not the rest of the franchise so much, but...
I don't know, he showed up a lot on Voyager, man.
He showed up a lot, but was he really important to that show? I don't know. Was he?
What was?
So anyway, yeah, the use of Q here as something which, I mean, I get the impression, and I'm sure that this can be confirmed through historical documents or whatever, but like they had always intended for Q to be this recurring character who, you know, whatever, and they used him here, and maybe they were originally intending for him to be somewhere down the road, but they ended up putting him in here. But it's so much more significant and important to the actual original story that this episode is trying to tell with the two space jellyfish and everything like that. And I just find it fascinating. And I mean, I know that this happens all the time in every show. I mean, you look at like the importance of Nog on Deep Space Nine and everything like that. But just the idea of like finding your story over time and realizing what works and what doesn't, and amplifying things and, you know, getting rid of other things in order to create, you know, super important television, you know? Just an interesting thing.
Yeah, I think it's important that early on they at least were very comfortable with the idea that they were going to, that they didn't know exactly where they were going and they were going to feel their way out.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, there's a... They managed with Q to create a character that ended up being a lot more important than he would initially seem. Because in this episode and in basically season one and season two, he's just kind of a nuisance.
Season two, I mean, you had Q Who. So that's where I think it really starts coming to, you know what I mean?
Yeah, Q Who is where it actually seems to turn. Like after that, it's almost, it's more like having, you know, Loki show up and like screw with things in order to make some point or make himself feel cool and accomplish something. And when he helps people out, he's got to like make a point like, yeah, I did that. See, like there's a playfulness to him after that point. But like season one Q is actually just a bad character. Like he's super powerful and is there just to mess with people and move the plot forward. Like it's an annoying thing that they used him like several times. Yeah, it's a bummer. But I am still shocked at how well he worked overall.
Yeah,
because this does not bode well for that.
No, I think when they realize that, you know, like adding, you know, kind of like a humorous element to the character, you know, was a way to go, and making it a character who's kind of like messing with Picard in a lot of ways, you know, treating it sort of like to Q, it's all a joke in a sense, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's when I think they really kind of like found how to make it work, because it's not, you know, he doesn't need to be this arch villain, which he kind of appears to be here. He needs to be just a guy who is super powerful, who's basically just messing with lesser beings. Right. And then,
yeah.
Yeah. I think that's, but they found it. They found it pretty quickly, you know, like 2 years, three episodes.
Yeah. And, but like by the end, it seems almost, it retroactively seems planned. Mm-hmm. And that's impressive. Cause I mean, I can tell you this, I was a kid and I was sick of him.
See,
I was done with this character, like, by his third appearance. I was like, all right, this is not a good character.
I mean, I think the first time I saw him was either Deja Q or Cupid. So, well, it might have been actually season six. Well, yeah, probably, because maybe, actually, you know what? It probably was True Q. For, you know, I don't know, but I got hit with like four like really good Q episodes sort of like in quick succession before I saw this, like Deja Q, Cupid, True Q, and then there's Tapestry, you know, and mm-hmm. it's like, okay, this is a good character. Oh, and not to mention also his appearance on DS9, which I saw as well. So yeah,
that episode's not great either.
I like it. But whatever. Anyway. So this whole trial thing, like this was, it's weird. Like historically, I do not like this episode. And, you know, just, I mean, even doing this commentary, like the thought of it was just like, oh my God, we just need to get through it. But when I went to watch it yesterday, it was not nearly as bad as I was anticipating, you know?
No, like it's not a complete disaster. Like there are episodes of season one that are. This is not that. It's just slow, and there are kind of two stories that don't really make sense together. It's not chocolate and peanut butter. It's I can't think of, I mean, you know, it's chocolate and fried rice. It's like you separately they're great. Together it's just confusing.
And you know, it's also like one of those things, of course, where since this is the pilot and, you know, season one has a lot of this, but the pilot is just packed with it. There's so much like, this is this character. This is what makes them unique. Let's really play up this thing. Or, you know, nobody knows who this person is, so let me tell you about how they did this prior to coming on the ship. This is their backstory, you know? And it's like you're just casually dropping that into conversation. That doesn't work, you know? That stuff gets a little annoying, and it feels super forced, which it is. But, you know, what can you do?
I don't know. Like, I'll tell you this. I was curious to rewatch this because there was one thing in my head that has been bugging me for you know, like a couple of years now, because I haven't watched this in a long time. But like this thing sort of like popped up into my head a while back, and then it kind of got like brought back into my consciousness fairly recently. And it is this. I could not remember where Riker was during a lot of this. And when I rewatched it, I was like, oh, it's because he's not there yet.
Yeah, he's on the planet and everything, right? So
yeah, like he's just not part of the story yet.
Yeah.
Like none of this involves him in any way. And then like he gets there and he's like, hey, do you have like a clip reel that I could review?
Yes,
to catch up.
Yes, we will get there. But yeah, he literally like the first thing that Picard makes Riker do is watch Encounter at Farpoint Part One.
Here's the thing, like, was there footage from this? Like,
no, there wasn't.
Did he have like one of those courtroom artist people like draw a quick version of it, and they did like a rough animatic, and he was like, and then I stood there and I was really handsome and I said to Q, this isn't cool, bro. And Q was like, okay, fine, whatever, I guess you're really cool, Picard. Like, I mean, it's, this whole thing is nuts. Like that, when he, there's a lot of banana stuff in this episode, and that is right up at the top.
Well, we'll get there eventually, but you can see like the editing that was done to Encounter at Farpoint for Riker's purposes was, while maybe better, not quite as thorough.
I love the idea that Riker watched a better version of this episode.
Well, it was shorter, you know, so that's the main thing. But
well, I can get a thesaurus out too.
What?
You said it's shorter. It's the same thing.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. All right. I missed that joke. Sorry.
All right.
Okay. So Q is going to test the Enterprise. He's going to put humanity on trial. One thing that we didn't mention, you know, at least according to the credits here, this episode is written by DC Fontana and Gene Roddenberry. So let's pretend that you're, you know, your current age back in 1987, and you're well versed in the history of Star Trek, and the credits for this episode come up on screen and it says written by DC Fontana and Gene Roddenberry. What are your thoughts?
Sounds great.
Yeah, right?
I mean, like if I had to pick like if I had to pick the writers of the first episode of a new Star Trek series, like at that when I was a kid, it would have been probably Gene Roddenberry,
of course.
But being an adult, if I were flung back in time, I'd be like, "Can we get Harlan for this?"
Yeah,
of course. I know that Gene's not going to be happy about it, and Harlan's probably going to be more unhappy about it than anyone. But like, can we do some kind of like Liam Neeson Taken scenario where we abduct him and force him to? Oh, it's a movie. I'll have to show it to you when it comes out in a couple decades. But like, it's like that would be the thing. Like that would be my goal, Harlan Ellison. But seeing DC Fontana and Gene Roddenberry as a kid, it was great. Seeing those two names as an adult in 1987, I think I would probably go, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I probably would have been like, yeah, let's do this, you know? And then by the end of it, I'd be like, what happened?
I think it's because Gene Roddenberry wrote one script and DC Fontana wrote another one. And then they drove the two scripts at each other at high speed.
They both whipped him across the room and then shuffled them back together. And
yeah, like there was a whole like 80s movie sequence where like two people were walking through a hallway, each carrying a script, and they bumped into each other and like their eyes met as they were like gathering their papers and standing up, and they had a whole love story and it was really charming and everything. But like, we didn't see off screen in that movie that they both ruined the project that they were working on.
What are you talking about?
I pitched a movie. Okay. I pitched a movie about two people meeting in the Paramount offices producing the script.
I was like, wait a minute, is he talking about something that actually happened? Okay. Anyway, sorry. I was distracted by this guy.
You were distracted by Jonathan Frakes.
Yes, the director of episodes 3 and 4 of Star Trek Picard.
He's a freaking handsome guy, you know? I understand.
He's a freaking handsome guy.
That's what I said.
Oh, I thought you said freaking. No. See, no, I keep on freaking. Ruining your jokes. Sorry.
Oh, God.
Maybe you should tell better jokes.
Maybe I should, like, send them to you in, like, a PDF before we record.
Okay. I'll be sure to not read that.
Okay.
So here we are into the story, which was the original story for this this thing. Really not very interesting. I mean, it is very Star Trek-y, you know, the idea of like, hey, there's this being that we're not really familiar with because it's not a humanoid sort of thing. Like, we don't understand it, but we can exploit it And then the Enterprise comes and says, you shouldn't be exploiting it because it's a thing, right?
It's a living creature, yeah.
So, I mean, that's cool. That's cool on paper.
It is cool on paper, but in practice, what we see doesn't really make any sense. Because they seem to have this creature, like, under control somehow.
Well, they say that the planet has a lot of energy, but they're giving it just enough to survive.
Yeah, but, like, they can do this. They can, like, keep this thing, like controlled by just, like, almost starving it. Like...
That seems reasonable to me.
It's super suspicious, though. Like, I find the whole thing, like we're going to snoop to find out what's going on. I would be much more confrontational about this. Yeah. It's very fishy.
Okay. So, here we meet the Crushers and also this guy who is not allowed to say anything because of SAG rules, I'm assuming. But yeah, Dr. Crusher and Wesley. Now here, Wesley, I think in a lot of ways was designed as a character for kids like you to relate to.
Yeah.
Did you relate to Wesley?
Oh, yeah.
So you were a Wesley fan.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like, I was the kid who was Picard is the guy I want to be when I'm a grown-up, and Wesley is the kid I want to be when I'm a teenager.
Okay. All right. That's cool.
And Riker is the guy I want to know and be friends with because he will help me deal with girls.
Okay. So, yeah, I think for me, even though I was a little bit older when I saw this, like I did like Wesley, but I also got to see sort of like Wesley the college years, you know. I think I would have been annoyed by the younger Wesley, but, you know, I liked older Wesley. But whatever. Maybe because I was the age of, I don't know, but whatever. And there's... LaForge.
Yeah, and it's crazy like how much better he got at looking not completely blind. Because in the first couple scenes, LeVar Burton looks like he cannot see anything. Like his head is basically looking at the people in the scene.
Well, yeah, he probably can't see anything, right?
He can't, but he doesn't know how to like match the eye lines yet.
Well, I'm wondering how much they were able to tweak the visor in order to allow him to see more.
I assume that they tweaked it a lot because, like, later on, we do see that there are little like slits in there, and you can see a little bit through them. But, like, I assume in the early episodes, he's straight up blind.
Yeah. I mean, that could be. Yeah. All right. So, Riker. Anyway, kind of interesting. The first time Riker's on the ship, it's only half there. So, oh, we got to make it so. Hey. I don't quite understand this. I don't understand what they're going for with the character here. I think that this is not the Picard that we know now, right? Like, he's strict and everything, but he's not like, I'm not going to turn to face you and say, hey, man, how's it going? Right? And it's not like he's doing stuff which is like super duper whatever. I mean, yes, they are in the middle of a crisis, but you'd think he'd at least turn around and be like, thanks for coming. Check out this new TV show. It's going to be on WPWR Power 50.
I think he was thinking, hey, there's like an alien god thing that's toying with us. I've read the file on this guy. I'm sure he's fine. Let's have him watch the clip show that Data assembled so that he knows what's up. And later on, I'll do some gamesmanship stuff and really poke him and see how he responds to it.
Well, he's already doing that. He's doing that here where he's saying, like, dock the thing manually, right?
Yeah, I don't. I think that that's him testing him. I don't. That to me, that doesn't seem like mind games. I think he's just like, all right, let's see how good you are at this. Later on, he's like, he's needling him to see how he reacts.
Here's Riker turning around. He calls that a little adventure. And then, you know, like the way that he turns around, I mean, like that whole sequence, that extended sequence just reeks of like, we're short on time, you know, like we don't. But, I'm also thinking that we're
short on time. Let's watch some of the stuff we've already seen.
Right.
Again.
Right. Because then we won't have to go back and shoot anything else. But I've also got to think that as Riker was watching that, he was like, oh, man, if they just let me direct this thing, I could do such a better job, you know.
Riker was thinking that. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. That checks out.
Yeah.
All right. Even as a kid, I hated these uniforms.
They don't work tremendously well. I mean, I was I don't know, blessed with the other uniforms. I saw those prior to this, so like anytime I saw these, I was like, oh, this was back when they didn't know what they were doing yet. Or, you know, if we're going to be completely honest, it's more like, oh, this is going to be a bad episode.
Yeah, you see that little stripe of color on their shoulder and you're like, oh no. Okay. All right.
Yep.
Let's do this.
Strap yourselves in. This one's gonna be rough. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
it's a bummer.
So we had the undocking, and that went on for a while, but now we have the docking.
Let's see the same shots, but in reverse.
Yes. It also explains, like, one of these shots here is like why, you know, because one that they reused where it was like, it starts on like right after the two dock, and then it like zooms out, I think, and to like the whole ship, and they used it a lot. And it was like one of those things where like in any other context, you're like, why are they zooming in on like the middle of the ship? Like, that's a super strange choice. We're zooming out of the middle of the ship. I forget. We'll see it in a minute, I'm sure. But
yep.
Yeah. And I love the idea that they were like, we've always wanted to do this. We're going to do it here. It's going to be all cool, and this will be a thing. And then it's so expensive that they're like, we'll do it one more time. Well, and then in the movie.
Yeah. There's a lot of weird stuff going on here. This episode really sets it up like this concept that they're going to be doing this a lot.
Yeah.
Like when they're in a lot of danger, they're going to just like, they're going to separate so that all the civilians can go off in one place and they'll free to go off and, you know,
this shot right here,
fire torpedoes and phasers and stuff.
Yeah. 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 Like you'd almost expect like there'd be some episodes like every episode of the original series would have started with, you know, the ship separated and you wouldn't even see the saucer section for like the entire episode.
Yeah, a fun thing. I remember like an interview where Gene Roddenberry was like, our intention was always on the original series that the saucer could separate.
Yeah.
And I don't buy that at all.
No,
that does not sound real.
I think that is legit. I think that that's something which is documented. Yeah. So.
Well, it would have looked even more stupid in that ship.
So,
and it looks kind of stupid here, so whatever.
Yeah. So he's drinking some tea, Earl Grey hot. I should be drinking tea, Earl Grey hot, but, you know, summer started, so.
So the tea is out of season? I don't understand.
Well, yeah, it's hot. It's hot outside, you know? It's hot and muggy, and, you know.
Why would you ever go outside?
Well, I'm not, but it's still hot and muggy in here, you know?
I don't know. I don't get it.
Okay.
I don't know why it would be.
All right.
My air conditioner is always on. It's always 68 degrees in here.
I haven't put in my air conditioner yet. So.
Oh, my God. How are you alive?
Well, it's only like 65 degrees outside.
All right. Keep rubbing your weather in my face.
Okay. All right. Oh, also, Riker doesn't have a beard here. So that's...
Yep. Here's the thing. The Starfield in the windows blew my mind. Blew my mind. In like now, looking back on it, it doesn't seem like a big deal. But back then, this was a big deal. Like, there's a Starfield in the distance, and it is slowly moving. That is huge. They did not have that on the original series.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
And that was a big deal. Like, to me, that was very significant. And I did spend a lot of time justifying why you never saw planets in the windows. Especially when the window should 100% be facing the planets. Mm.
It happens.
What are you going to do?
So here we get to find out all about LaForge's visor.
Yes.
It's just like, okay, guys, like we need to let everybody know what makes every single character unique. You know, interesting here, like that the Enterprise has a moon roof. And that's cool. And my car has a moon roof, and I keep on wanting to open it up. And my wife is like, I don't want you opening that up when I'm in the car, because what if a bird flies over us and craps inside? And I'm like, how many times have you been walking down the street and a bird's crapped on your head? You know, and like, that's, the odds are not in the bird's favor there. And when I was watching this yesterday, I was like, they've got a moon roof, you know? Oh, so why can't we use our moon roof? And she's like, do you see them opening it up? Like, before they go into the battle, are they like shields up and moon roof up? And I'm like, no, but that doesn't mean that they can't.
I'm having a really hard time figuring out how this is in any way related.
What do you mean? They've got a moonroof. We just saw it.
Yeah, they do. But so did the original series Enterprise.
Well, just in one shot of one episode. But did they really? Or was that a... Okay, all right. Anyway, speaking of the original series, here's... McCoy.
Mm-hmm. Deforestation Kelly.
And he's really old. 137. Yeah,
he's very plausibly old.
And here
he seems like an actual old person.
Here's the thing which I love about this, which I did not realize until I was watching it yesterday. He's got a glittery future space old guy sweater.
Yes, he does.
I like it. It works.
It does?
Yeah, he's got the little patches on the elbows and everything.
Well, that's news to me, because I did not think that it worked.
I think it's funny.
But now I know that it works.
Yeah. And then
I would have said it looks insane.
There's a thing where, like, I'm sure that scene, like, was always going to be in there because, you know, of course, right? But, like, you watch that, and it's like... Oh, it does not need to be there. Like, if that was just random, you know, medical officer, like, that scene would not exist. Like, the whole thing is like, you know, oh, the guy from Starfleet Medical, he's leaving, but he didn't, wait, but he doesn't want to beam over? Okay, let's cut to this thing and then fade to black. Also, here, this scene, like, I never noticed this until now, but like, Picard comes in, right? And he's all happy. And he's like, did you send the message to the captain? And he's like, yeah, I used your exact words. Bonjour, mon ami. And Picard's like, oh, what did he say? What did he say? And it's like, you just said bonjour, mon ami. Like, for whatever reason, Picard's like, this is going to kill. Like, just say bonjour, mon ami. You know what I mean?
So you think Picard was like you're gonna they're gonna blow, they're gonna like freak out when they hear that this is gonna be a killer joke. Yep. I want to hear their reaction. Like bonjour, mon ami. When I drop that,
and maybe that's what it is. Maybe that was like the intention, right?
Clear the stage.
To which I wanted to know like the backstory. Like I imagine whatever the reason why this captain would find that to be hilarious, like I imagine that would make for a much better episode than Encounter at Farpoint.
Bro, there's so many better episodes of Star Trek happening just in the margins of this.
Yeah.
Like how are these tailors at Farpoint Station like making a profit? I want to know what's going on there. I'm very fascinated with the economics of this franchise.
Yes.
There's a lot going on there. Like I want to know like what is Bones doing on this ship at this point? Why is it important that he's there? Why are they rendezvousing in the middle of nowhere? Like, there's a lot of weird stuff happening in this episode, and so much of it doesn't make sense. Why isn't that shot? Why isn't that scene with him at the end? Why isn't that the last scene?
I could see it not being the last scene, but I can't see how they would fit it in anywhere else either. Oh, and then there's this thing which they totally pay off.
Oh, yeah. I love how this thread continues throughout the entire run of the series. That Riker and Troy can communicate telepathically. That's great. I love how they really maintain that. Like, they honor this scene, and they don't just drop it.
But also, like, I mean, yes.
We don't know how to use this.
Yes, I know that they get together. I know that they get together in Nemesis, right? But, like, or actually, I guess they get together in Insurrection. But regardless,
That's not the issue. The issue is that they can read each other's thoughts.
No, there's that. But just the idea, like, even beyond that, because they couldn't, they obviously didn't have Troy, you know, quite figured out yet. But why?
Yeah, it took him a while to figure out Troy.
Why?
I think they figured her out about 2 weeks ago.
But why would they not continue that relationship? Why would you not? I mean, they changed the relationship and they ended up becoming like best buds and then eventually got married. But why would you not? Like, why would you set up like, these people have a really close relationship and, you know, they used to be in love and everything like that. And then basically be like, we're not going to deal with that at all for the entire series. Why wouldn't you do that?
I always read it as Roddenberry's ideals about sexual relationships in the future. Like, I always read it like, he saw them as being so in love and so evolved that they no longer were jealous of each other being in other relationships. So Riker could date people, Troy could date people, and they were both still in love with each other.
But you would think that they would date each other.
I think that they do. I think that they are in a committed relationship. They just have sex with other people. I think that it's what Gene Roddenberry wanted to happen in present day.
But you don't see that here. You don't.
No, I think that the intention was that that's what's going on, and that's why it wasn't confirmed or refuted, because they didn't really want to show that, and it throws up some red flags for some viewers, and they also didn't want to confirm that it wasn't the case, because that would kind of, you know, shut down that interpretation. So we got neither.
I think you're thinking about it too much, or you know, certainly more than the writers were or whatever. I think that the intention was really like, okay, these people have a past. Like, they used to be in love. Now they're, you know, not, but now they have to work together again. That's going to be awkward. And, you know.
I mean, look, if we were doing, if this podcast was about, like the sexual, like revolution that is purported to have occurred in between present day and the future of Star Trek's timeline, then we could go into depth about this and we could find episodes and I'd be like, see, here they kind of confirm this and here they kind of confirm this. And here it seems very clear that what they're saying is that Troy and Riker are beyond jealousy and they are very much into each other, but they don't need each other to be exclusive. It seems like it's there. There are pieces. It's spread out over the course of 7 years. It's dumb. And it's a small issue, but I do believe that it is there.
Okay. All right. Oh, it's the holodeck. Another thing which was originally intended for the original series. And which eventually ends up on the animated series.
Yeah. Well, previously ended up on the animated
series. Yeah,
it's this is the early holodeck before they revamped the holodeck, where it is a lot better, but also still kind of difficult to determine in what way it's better, because all we really know is that it looks incredibly realistic. And it can even simulate rocks that are slightly wobbly, only when you're not looking at them.
Okay. When you're not looking at them, what?
Yeah, there's a shot like you see Wesley step on this rock. It does not wobble. He falls into the water, and then Riker runs up and stands on the exact same rock that does not wobble, and he pulls Wesley out. It's a bad scene.
All right. I used to have a lot of trouble with holodecks just in general. I mean, like, Wesley falls into the water. And then he's soaking wet, you know, like that kind of thing. And I'm like, how is he soaking wet? Because like it was like computer generated water, right? So it's not like real thing. But I mean, thinking about it now, I guess like just the way, I mean, they talk about like how replicators work and everything like that. Like you could create like real water inside the holodeck and have it, you know, exist.
Yeah, look, if you want my interpretation, the way I see it is like I justify it in my head this way. This episode of the holodeck, it's the previous holodeck before they revamped the tech. So when there is a body of water, the holodeck replicates a whole bunch of water in order for people to fall into the water and swim through like a swimming pool or something like that. And that's how the water exists. And then later on, when they revamp the technology, if you, for example, fall off of a boat into the water, then when you get off of the holodeck, the problem is then you're soaking wet and you get water all throughout the ship. So that's kind of inconvenient. So when they revamped the tech, they changed it so that it doesn't carry the water, the bodies of water out. But if you have a glass of water and you want to drink that glass of water, that's different. So the holodeck uses some sort of interpretation to determine what things should be replicated and which things should just be holographically represented.
Okay. I mean, speaking of like things which, boy, do not need to be in this episode, we've been walking around the holodeck for a really long time, you know? Already. We're still walking.
Yeah. It's, buddy, this is not a great episode. I mean,
I guess they're giving us like everything that's different. Right? But, geez, you know, I mean, you could do it more elegantly. I mean, what's the first holodeck episode? Is it the big goodbye?
I think it is, yeah.
So.
Not wobbly at all.
So put all of the holodeck stuff in there. And, oh, man, I guess we all have friends like this who are just, like, super energetic and eager to help you out, like, super-duper quickly, even when you're just like, don't just, I can stand up. I can walk out of this water, but, like, Data, like, jumping like a madman trying to get to Crusher, you know, and then like lifting him up out of his head and smiling.
Wesley is not a toddler. Like, he's fine. Like, it's actually, like, honestly, it's pretty rude that Data is like, I got you, bro. There you go. I saved you from that, like, hip waist, like, that waist high water that you were trapped in that might have killed you if you, like, lost your footing, hit your head, and fell unconscious under the water and then drowned. Although that seems very implausible. It's not a great beat.
Yeah. But that's okay.
Well, I mean, you can justify it because Data doesn't know that he made Wesley feel stupid just now.
Yeah. So here are the Crushers plotting to get Wesley on the bridge.
Yep. And Wesley is wearing the craziest sweater that he wears in this episode.
But not in the series. And it's also
only to be outdone every single time he appears.
But it's also, like, really big, or, like, in the future.
It's so weird. I wish that there was a company that just sold all of Wesley's sweaters.
I'm surprised.
So that I could buy them for people and give them as gifts, and then just feel very proud that I gave someone something that they would never have the opportunity to wear.
Oh, you wouldn't wear that?
I would not. I don't wear sweaters.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess you live in the middle of a swamp, so.
No, I never wore sweaters. I don't understand them. I think they're stupid. Like, to me, it's like, if you're going to wear a shirt or you're going to wear a jacket, you're wearing a sweater. Where are you? What is this? This is not a thing. Don't wear sweaters. Guys, sweaters are dumb. Let's go off topic and talk about sweaters for the rest of this. What is the point of them? There are jackets. There are coats. There are lots of things for dealing with the cold. And if you want to deal with the cold, you put on a jacket or a coat or something like that. You don't, like, do a half measure and wear a sweater. They're dumb.
They serve a purpose, but regardless of any of that. So here we are, and now we're investigating, trying to figure out what's going on in this episode. And it takes a long time.
Yeah, and Troy is like, I kept my mind closed. You know how you do that. And then she opens her mind, and she's like, whoa, that was a mistake. This is not a good place to open your mind doors, because it's bad. Because of all the depression, the real, like, agony and frustration that this alien being feels. Oh, this is...
it was a good idea. It was a good idea. You know, the empath, it just, they never found, like, the middle ground where it works, you know? I mean, they're either doing this, which is, like, over the top, or they're, like, nothing. Like, we're not going to mention it for, like, a season and a half, you know?
There are a few episodes where Troy, like her abilities really work. And, like, they're all kind of Troy-centric episodes, though. They're all, like, oh, she's turned into a Romulan for an episode and that kind of thing. Like, they use her well occasionally, but for the most part, like, her ability is a problem for the writers. Because she's just like, oh, that guy's lying. And they, you know, shoot him. And it's like, well, we avoided that potential adventure for the next 42 minutes. Thank goodness for me being here. Let's all go to the holodeck and, you know, just chill.
It is crazy. I mean, you can see this with all of the actors, but in particular, I would say like Marina Sirtis. I mean, just because I think what they're asking her to do in this episode is like rather ridiculous, but like you look at her in that last scene compared to like any episode from like season 7 of the show, and it's just like, whoa, you know, like it took them, you know, a few episodes to figure out how best to work that character, like you know, I mean, abilities of you know, empathic abilities aside, but geez, you know, I mean, they were not utilizing Marina Sirtis's talents to their fullest extent early on in this series. You know what I mean?
Oh, of course not. But like, honestly, kind of no one is. Oh,
well, yeah, but I mean, I think with her, I mean, it's most blatant. You know?
Yeah, her it's the worst, because early on they really didn't know what to do with her, because like at this point everyone kind of is like their two sentence description. Mm-hmm. Really?
Yeah.
Like Data is like the android that wants to be human. Wesley is the kid that wants to be in Starfleet. Geordi is the guy who can't see and is in constant pain.
Yep.
Worf is the Klingon who wants to shoot everything.
and he does that here.
Yeah. I mean, he almost shoots the TV at one point.
Yeah, because I mean, that's just a mistake that sometimes people make.
You know how when like you're watching a horror movie and something appears on the screen and you shoot your TV?
And the thing about it is like,
here's the thing about it. That is a bad moment in this show's history.
It is, but like the thing about it that makes it even worse, I think, in a lot of ways, is the fact that Picard's like, are you just going to shoot a hole in the TV? Like,
but Picard shuts him down so hard. Like, Worf, honestly, this is why we don't take you anywhere.
But I mean, it's like, yes, you know, I mean, like, that's like the honest reaction if someone did that. But it's like, even Picard, like even the character in the show, knows what it how dumb it is to do that thing, you know. Like,
so
what was the reasoning behind that? I don't know.
The reasoning behind it was Klingons are dumb, aren't they? They're so dumb. They don't get it. This is not. It's not great for a lot of the characters, because they are playing the two line description of the character and not any of the nuance that they develop over the years. They've all got kind of a burden to deal with, and Patrick Stewart kind of has it the best, where his two-line description is, he's the captain of the ship. He's not super great with kids.
That's true.
So, like, he's got a lot of room to work with. Like, he's like, he's got space. He's like, all right, I'm the captain of the ship. I'm not great with kids. That's not really very limiting, is it?
But it's...
That's sort of like, I'm great at everything but kids. Okay, I can work with this.
But it's also like they didn't quite know... Like, since they didn't like know anything about him yet, they were like, let's try weird things. Like, oh, his first officer will come on board and he's just like not going to talk to him. You know, he's not going to acknowledge his presence like that. Maybe that's the character. It's someone who, you know, is really, really rude to his coworkers, you know?
Yeah, but then he immediately kind of undercuts it and is like, I think you're going to be great. This is going to be awesome. You're going to be a good first officer. Like, there's a lot going on with Patrick Stewart's role here. He's doing a lot. Troy's kind of got it the worst. Like, no, Michael Dorn has it the worst. Like, because he is just the Klingon in a Starfleet uniform. It looks kind of silly, and he kind of doesn't have anything to do with it. It's a bummer. But like, Troy's got to do like capital A acting, and it does look silly.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting that from what I understand, Worf was originally just supposed to be like a recurring character, and they ended up making him a regular because they liked him. I don't know if it was because they liked Michael Dorn or because they liked the character, but no, it's interesting.
I assume it was both.
Yeah.
Because it's interesting that he's a Klingon, and everyone, I know that as a kid, like, my feeling was, what? There's a Klingon on the ship? That's a big deal. Like, that means a lot of stuff happened in between what we last saw and where they are.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, it was the show was a ways in before, like, Undiscovered Country dropped.
Yeah.
And as a kid, I was like, okay, they're laying the groundwork here for, like, what we eventually see. And that makes sense. Because, like, I mean, like, in at the time, it was like we were still really like we were in the Cold War. We were deep in the Cold War. Like, Chernobyl had happened. And so we knew that the Soviet Union was having troubles. And we kind of anticipated that at some point we would no longer be rivals or potential enemies. But it was still the case that we had a hard time imagining, like, long-term, like tension being completely gone to the point where these different cultures are just, like, working together, and, like, there are Klingons on Starfleet on Starfleet ships, and there are humans on Klingon ships. That second part never really happened.
Yeah. All right. So that's a miniature, just kind of.
Oh, no, really? That's a miniature? I assume that was an actual small town that they set fire to.
It's weird. Like, with everything getting, like, upgraded to HD and everything like that, I've been noticing that miniature work is the stuff that becomes, like, super noticeable first, yeah. I think. Like, I just saw, like, the new 4K transfer of Batman, and oh my god, you can see miniatures all over the place in that now.
Well, I mean, that was kind of true all along. Like,
yeah,
that
but movie, now it's, like, really obvious.
All right. I always kind of thought that was, like, the one redeeming quality of that movie. Like, the charm of, like, how they composited in miniatures and, like, kept showing miniatures of the city. Like, that, like, to me, the best part of that movie is, like, the sets.
I'm not sure if I would say that, but it's a good part.
No, it's true. It's the best part of the movie.
So here's where they're realizing that Groppler Zorn may be not all that he's cracked up to be.
Oh, also, terrible name for a character.
What is a Groppler?
It's nothing. It's meaningless.
I mean, Zorn's a good name.
No, Zorn is a ridiculously it's a ridiculous alien name. It's like the Star Trek has a history of bad alien names. I think the Vorgons are the worst. Because, like, come on, guys, it's just Vogons. You just put an R in there. Mm. Oh, and you also have a Horgon in that episode. So
there's one line in here, you know, because obviously they were trying to separate themselves from the original series, even though they had, you know, DeForest Kelly in it and everything. But, like, the Ferengi, of course, as everyone knows, was originally intended to be, like, the big, like, that was going to be their Klingons, right? The Ferengi. And yeah. There's the line in here where they're like, oh, yeah, go ahead and make your deal with the Ferengi. It'll be interesting to see if they find you as tasty as the last people they worked with.
Yeah.
Implying that, like, Ferengi eat people.
Yeah, like, they have a contract and they pay money, and then they're like, oh, we want that money back. Let's eat these people. Like, to me, like, in retrospect, I just go, he's just lying. He's just bluffing.
Yeah, maybe that's what it is. Or I kind of thought, like, since he's like, hopefully they find you as tasty as they did, maybe he's just being metaphorical, you know?
Or maybe he's being lascivious. Maybe it's like a sex joke. Like he's like, maybe they think you'll be as hot as the last people that they worked with, and they were really into them.
Yeah.
Maybe he's just being sincere. Maybe he's just like, hey, maybe they like you.
So here's Data being all androidy, all systems operating, you know. Yep. And he gives that smile like, all right, cool. I'm cool, right?
Yeah, he's dealing with a lot. Brent Spiner really handled his very bare bones character description very well.
Well, he figured it out as he went along too, you know?
Yeah, I mean, like, but this isn't an embarrassing thing. Like, he's doing the android thing, and in retrospect, it seems off because of who we know Data to be. But it's still working well here.
I don't know. I think that if he would have went with this characterization for all 7 years, I'd be like, I hate Data so much. I really hate Data. I don't know.
Oh, no, I agree. I did not like him. Yeah. I thought that he was a bad character early on. I was not a fan of Data.
Like a couple, I don't know, maybe a season in, I'm like, oh, Data's cool. I like Data, you know?
Yeah, I think that I kind of came around on Data around like season 5. I was like, oh, okay, I see what they're doing. Yeah, it's interesting. It's really, it's a solid, like, from a philosophical perspective, the idea that, like, we're seeing, like, humanity in a weird way where, like, he is just a person. He just doesn't quite know it yet.
You didn't get that with Measure of a Man?
No, that's like he's real. He is a being. He exists. He has personhood, but he, like, the emotion thing, like, they really played that up. Like, he doesn't have intention. He doesn't have personal goals. Like, without his, like, his sense of duty, he would just be a really effective machine. They didn't really figure out, like, that he is just a straight up human made by a person. Like, they didn't figure that out until a ways in, and then they ruined it in Generations. But, like, that's when I turned around on Data. I was like, okay, no, he's good. He's a good character. Here, I was just like, yeah, I get it. He's an android. I don't really care if he becomes a human or not. Mm-hmm. And here they're proving their point to Q, and Q's like, all right, I guess. I guess. Whatever. You didn't completely screw this up. I'll just hang around and keep judging you guys.
It so feels like the episode's wrapping up, and yet we still have 15 minutes in it.
Oh, we have so much time. So much time. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a lot of things going on for an episode that has resolved all of the major conflicts.
And here we have another one of these scenes where it's like, okay, this is nice and good and everything in the context of the series, but, like, why is it in this episode? You know? It's like, sorry I didn't say hi to you, and sorry I yelled at your kid, but, you know, like, if you want to leave, you can totally leave. And then she's like, if I wanted to leave, I wouldn't have requested to come here. And he's like, what? And you think, like, maybe he would know that? I don't know. You know? Maybe not.
I assume not. I assume that, I mean, in my head, you don't know, like, who requests to go where, because most likely you're just like, hey, can you assign me there? And the person who assigns people assigns it. Like,
see, I kind of assumed that it was like as far as, like, the chiefs of staff or whatever, it was kind of like a director assembling, like, a crew, right? Like, you're going to pick your cinematographer, you're going to pick your editor and everything like that. Like, you're not going to just let someone assign, like, a chief medical officer to you, right? But maybe that's not how it works. I'm curious to know how it works now.
I assume that it doesn't work. I that is exactly the opposite of how I would see it. Because, like, they're supposed to be, like you can slot one person in and slot them out. Like, you can, they're supposed to be interchangeable. They fill the role that they've been assigned to, like, perfectly. They nail it. Whatever the job is, they nail it so that they, like, the role can be replaced.
Mm-hmm. I guess that's usually more how it's like, but... And that, I mean, just like in terms of just like structure and everything, they're like, we're going to beam down. Okay, I'm going to go talk to the doctor. And then there's that line of dialogue, which, you know, watching it now with the subtitles makes me think that it was added in. I mean, obviously it was added in post, but I mean, it was added like it wasn't originally scripted where Riker's like, we're ready to beam down now. And then he leaves. Like, boy. Like that, just the placement of these scenes is just like so like inappropriate in terms of like the story, you know? I don't know.
Yeah, it is badly paced. It is, it's, this episode is, it goes on for too long. They're trying to make it work, but it's got the story of one episode and it's way too long. Mm. It's troubling. Like, honestly, like, it, as the show progressed, like, I would talk about the show, like, oh, it's a great show, you should watch this show, and people would ask where to start, and I would say whatever the next episode is.
Mm-hmm.
And it was because it was currently airing and you couldn't go back and start the show at the beginning, but once that was a thing, I became very concerned that people would start this show with this and then season one and then season two. Because I felt like if you start watching The Next Generation and the first thing you watch is Encounter at Farpoint, you are done.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that that's kind of interesting, especially now, you know, looking at things like Discovery and stuff like that and whatever people think about season one and now season two of Discovery, it's like, you compare it to what in a lot of ways is considered to be like the gold standard of the franchise, like Next Generation. And it's like, geez, you know, I mean, the places that Discovery can go, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, like if you compare like the beginnings of these series to each other, Next Generation makes the original series look terrible. Deep Space Nine makes Next Generation look stupid, and Voyager makes them both look slow and boring. And Enterprise makes them look like set in their ways, old fuddy-duddy series. And like Discovery makes them all look like your dad's Star Trek. And like, but like when you compare these things like over time and their influence on the franchise, TNG does stand out. And I in the way I see it, to a great extent, it is because of Jean-Luc Picard. Like, to me, this show is number one because of him.
Not because of Riker?
No, not because of Riker.
I just thought because of number one, but yeah. No, I see what you're saying. And I think that that's true. And it's interesting because unlike the original series, which is very much the Kirk show, right?
Yeah.
Like, this is much more of an ensemble cast. And yep. Everybody does have their moment to shine. And yet he's still there watching over everything.
He is still there, but that's the thing. This is the weird paradoxical thing about like the lesson to be learned from these shows, not the episodes themselves, but the shows themselves and the people on these shows. What we know about the original series and William Shatner's role on the original series and behind the scenes is that he kind of pulled attention to himself. He kind of wanted it to be the Kirk show. He wanted it to be a showcase for himself. And Patrick Stewart did kind of the opposite from the start. He was like, I'm going to do my job great. I'm going to make everyone else look great. And we're going to make this show great. And I'm going to do whatever it takes to make this show great. And we know, like, from the stories that early on he was very serious because he was so concerned about screwing up. And as he became more comfortable and having more fun, we like the lesson of this is be a generous person and you will come out great. Like, things work out when you are there for the team. And he was there for the team on the show and behind the scenes. And to me, that is why I do love Patrick Stewart. And I really love Jean-Luc Picard.
Yeah, he seems like a really cool guy, you know? I mean, you just hear like some stories about him and he just seems like really kind of like down to earth and everything like that. And
For a guy with his abilities and his history and his experience.
Yeah.
Like, it's amazing.
There's some story which he told where, like, because he lives in New York or whatever, and, you know, he was, like, on the subway, and some random guy came up to him, and he's like, way to keep it real, man, you know? Mm-hmm. And even my, like, I've told this before, I think, but when I was in Vegas, like, I was checking through security, and I had, like, a Star Trek shirt on, and the security guard was like, yesterday Patrick Stewart came through here, and I was like, why are you flying Southwest? And he said, what do you want me to fly, the Enterprise? It's good.
It's, I don't know.
And also, like, the fact that it was his idea to show up at Vegas and announce this show, right? Yeah. Even though he was not scheduled to attend, he's like, this is how we do it, right?
Yeah, and like, also, like, seeing on his face the, like, the emotional component of saying these things, like,
yeah,
I'm coming back to Star Trek and we're doing this thing. And it's like, okay, like, I felt like I needed this, and seeing it on him, it's like, oh, he felt he needed this.
Yeah. Which is like cool, because, like, I mean, you think about the history and it's like, this was just a job for him. He thought that this show was going to get canceled and everything like that. And now, yeah. I mean, it has changed his life. It's become his life and everything. And I really do think that Logan has a lot to do with it. I think
I
being
too.
Involved with that and seeing what could happen. And like, I went to a thing that they did for like the Chicago Film Festival where they gave him like a Lifetime Achievement Award. And he talked about how like he sat at the premiere of Logan next to Hugh Jackman. Mm-hmm. And like, as it was ending, he started getting like really emotional and he was kind of like embarrassed by it. And he looked over at Hugh Jackman and Hugh Jackman was crying. So then he started crying and the two of them just held hands and cried and watched the end of Logan together.
Yeah.
I mean, that's cool.
And I assume at some point over the following few weeks, he was like, yeah, you know, oh, the last time I was Picard, that was Nemesis.
That's, I bet you that had a lot to do with it, you know?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I also, I think back on this a lot. Whenever we talk about, like Star Trek's history and, like, William Shatner and Patrick Stewart, like, I think about this scene from The Captains where Shatner and Stewart are talking, and Stewart is like, I know that, like, when I die, people will remember me primarily as Captain Jean-Luc Picard of Star Trek, and I'm absolutely fine with that. And Shatner's reaction, he just says, wow. And like, you see on Shatner's face, like, the realization, but Patrick Stewart is like already there. He's like, I was Captain Jean-Luc Picard. This is the best. Like, whatever I do after this, I'm good. And the idea that he's cool with that, and the idea that he can like pass on that kind of like almost spiritual wisdom of like appreciating it, is really powerful. And I Yeah, I mean, it's weird how easily Patrick Stewart can move me to tears, because like, it doesn't take a lot. It just he's the dad I wanted.
It's interesting because when Logan came out, and if you guys haven't seen Logan, I mean, it's weird, but go check out Logan. I mean, really. And, you know, when that came out, I was thinking about it and I was like, okay, so this was 2018 or 2017? 2017, I guess. And I'm like, okay, first X-Men movie came out in 2000. So Patrick Stewart has been playing Professor X for 17 years now. And 87 to 2002, he only played, from Encounter at Farpoint to Nemesis, he only played Captain Picard for 15 years. He played Professor X longer than he played Captain Picard. And I'm like, that's kind of a bummer, in a sense.
Yeah.
And now, well, he's officially surpassed that. And now, you know. He's going to be playing Captain Picard for who knows how long.
Yeah, it's really good that we're starting here, because by the time this new show rolls around, I'm gonna just be giddy. I know my reaction to this guy and this character. I don't know how critical I will be.
What happens if it sucks?
If Star Trek Picard sucks, I'm not sure I will be aware of it.
You know, that's how it works sometimes, right? I mean, we've all been there. So,
yeah. I know me, and I know once he says his name, I'm going to probably cry, and I will be, oh, God, I'm getting emotional.
There you go.
I'm having a hard time thinking about it. It's just it's so significant.
Mm-hmm.
It's huge. This is the craziest thing that's ever happened.
ever in the history of anything?
Yeah, we split the atom. That's like a third this.
Yeah.
That's nothing.
I mean, that's why, you know, and this is what I said, watching that Deep Space Nine documentary, right? And even that weekend, right? I so badly wanted to ask him, but there wasn't really an opportunity at panels or anything like that. But the day before Picard was announced, right? Iris Stephen Bear was up there on stage, and you know, someone was like, "So, Deep Space Nine movie, would you guys want to come back?" And he's like, "Of course we would come back." But it's never going to happen. So, you know what? You're just going to have to enjoy the movie in your head. And, you know, I wanted to go back the next day and be like, there's a lot that happened between yesterday and today.
Yeah.
That's not, you know, I mean, and that's what, you know, there was that season one thing in the What We Left Behind documentary where they break the first episode of season eight of Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
Of course, it was really good. We have a Picard show coming out now. This is not outside the realm of possibility. Let's make it happen, you know?
Yeah, I mean, we're in a new era where, these things have an audience. There's a possibility we could get something like that.
There are no rules.
There are no rules anymore. We could get anything. I think that it's not outside. It's a possibility, and I think that that's pretty great. That said, Picard does it for me. I'm all in on this.
It's going to be cool. All right. Well, thank you for joining us for this brand new show. We're glad that you're listening, and we're glad that Captain Picard has his own show coming out. And in the meantime, you can find us online. You can go to the Babel Conference, which is our listeners group on Facebook, and find us there and talk about this episode and what your thoughts are on Encounter at Farpoint and Picard coming back. You can also find us on Twitter. I'm at Mumbles3K, And you're at?
J. Max Hagel.
Yeah, and you can find us on our website, filmdamagepod.com, doing a show called Film Damage sporadically, you know, when they're not making Star Trek, which seems to be always now. So, you know, what's up with that? Yeah. And yeah, until next time, the line must be drawn here and no further. I guess not, right? We'll be back next time to talk about all good things.